Welcome to Cross Cultural Poetics. Poets and writers from all over the world talk about their art and their language. I'm Leonard Schwartz. Today's guest on the phone from New York is Elias Khoury. He was born in Beirut in 1948 and is the author of 11 novels, 4 volumes of literary criticism, and 3 plays. His most recent book in English translation is Gate of the Sun, translated from the Arabic by Humphrey Davies and published by Archipelago Books. Welcome, Elias Khoury.
Thank you.
Great to have you on the phone, and New York is participating with us in this reading. I can hear it in the background murmuring and speaking, and that's good. I always miss the city. Great to have you on the phone. Can you say a little bit about a quote of yours I came across in a recent interview? You write, "Memory cannot express itself in a single narrative, and while writing, I discovered the richness of the Palestinian experience and of the human experience. Literature exposes the richness of the human experience, which has no single narrative." When you write a book like The Gate of the Sun, which deals with the Nakba or the events of 1948 that lead that are the Palestinian expulsion, but also approach it from a perspective that memory cannot express itself in a single narrative, well, how does that affect or transform the way you think of yourself as a novelist?
No, I think this is the work of novelists. First of all, there is no one narrative. If there is a reference to all the storytelling in world literature, it would be 1001 Night. And if one goes to 1001 Night, he will discover that there is no one narrator, no one narrative. There are complexities of narratives. Narratives are juxtaposing. Narratives are mirrors to other narratives in order to enable the book to embarrass, to hold on all this human experience. So I think this is the major thing of literature. If literature is only one narrative, then it's no more literature. It's mostly ideology. I think literature has the capacity to overcome ideology and to show up how human experiences are complex, how human experiences have many dimensions in the same time. And this is how I think literature is now dealing with the Palestinian Nakba or catastrophe. Nakba, actually, the term Nakba means catastrophe, but it's used to speak about Palestinian expulsion from Palestine in 1948. The Palestinian Nakba in itself is a huge human event, because what we see behind the political scene is something much more interesting and much more powerful. We see the human suffering and how human beings, how individuals, how a whole people faced the catastrophe with will, with love of life, and with imagination.
It's very, very clear in reading your book, which I loved, and that there's that wealth of narratives that you're describing, narratives that encompass the Nakba, not narratives that encompass the attempt to imagine the other, to even imagine the circumstance of the Holocaust, for example. There's a way in which stories are asked to save lives, I think, in your writing, and that reference to the 1001 Nights is really intriguing to think about as well. There is, however, a narrative structure that's built around one person speaking for another person. There's one character who's in a coma, and then there's another character who's attempting to be a doctor or has had some medical training in China and is playing the role of a doctor when the real doctors have given up on the patient. Can you say a little bit about that decision on your part in terms of narrative structure, that the story should be told for a person in a coma by another person attending at bedside?
No, actually, it's a kind of a long monologue, because the man in the coma cannot hear. And the man in the coma was a way for Khalil, for the major narrator, to go through a long, long monologue and to try to collect the story of Yunis, who is the guy, the man in the coma, and behind him to collect the stories of love, because Yunis's story majorly is a love story. And the interesting part of it, as Yunis speaks about himself, is not that he was a fighter for Palestine, but that he was a lover. And actually, he to cross the border, penetrate the Israeli borders, not only to meet and only to fight, but mainly to meet his beloved one. So in order to reconstruct this whole life story, and to permit to Khalil to tell also the story of his own generation, I thought the situation which Khalil is in will permit him to tell freely, because he's telling the story of the other who is in coma, and the other cannot reply, so he can not only tell the real story, but he can also imagine and invent and construct and deconstruct in the same time. And actually, Khalil is not the only narrator, because every time there is a new character who emerges, he'll become the narrator himself. So actually, it's a combination of many narrators who are trying together to fill up the gap in the Palestinian memory and to fill up the gap in the Palestinian history. Actually, Nakba, the Palestinian Nakba, was never written before. Palestinians are the victims, and normally the victims do not write the history. What is left for them is to write stories. And in this sense, this struggle between the story and history is what was the most important part of this work. I think that story, in the end, the story only can win, because story speaks about real human experiences, whereas history is the outcome which the victors can impose upon others.
Right. History as that which is written by the victors, right. And art and poetry, and indeed the novel as the imaginative work that attempts to overcome that apparent victory. I appreciate that formulation of it. I wondered if we could read a little bit from your novel, The Gate of the Sun. We're speaking with Elias Khoury, the Lebanese author, global distinguished professor of Middle Eastern and Islamic Studies at New York University. And the book, 1998, The Gate of the Sun, won the Palestinian Prize, and in 2002 was named by Le Monde Diplomatique the Book of the Year, finally available in English translation through Archipelago Books. Could we read perhaps in Arabic and English from the first chapter?
Okay.
Fantastic.
Matat Umm Hassan.
Umm Hassan is dead. I saw everyone racing through the alleys of the camp and heard the sound of weeping. Everyone was spilling out of their houses, bent over to catch their tears, running. Nabila, Mahmoud al-Qassami's wife, our mother, was dead.
كنا ندعوها يا أمي لأن كل الذين ولدوا في مخيم شتيلة سقطوا من أحشاء أمهاتهم إلى يديها.
We called her mother because everyone born in the Shatila camp fell from their mother's guts into her hands.
وأنا أيضا سقطت إلى يديها ورقدت يوم موتها.
I too had fallen into her hands, and I too ran the day she died.
جاءت أم حسن من الكويكات قريتها في الجليل لتصبح القابلة الوحيدة في مخيم شتيلة.
Umm Hassan came from Al-Qaikat, her village in Galilee, to become the only midwife in Shatila, a woman of uncertain age and without children.
امرأة لا عمر لها ولا أولاد وأنا لا أعرفها إلا كهلة كتفان منحنيان وجه مليء بالتجاعيد والغضون وعينان كبيرتان تلتمعان في الوجه الأبيض المربع وشال أبيض يغطي شعر رأسها الأبيض.
I only knew her when she was old, with stooped shoulders, a face full of creases, large eyes shining in a white square, and a white cloth covering her white hair.
قالت جارتها سناء زوجة كريم الجشي بائع الكنافة إن أم حسن مرت بها ليلة أمس وأخبرتها أن الموت سيأتي.
Our neighbor, Sana, the wife of Karim al-Jashi, the kunafa seller, said Hassan dropped in on her the night before last and told her death was coming. I heard its voice, daughter. Death whispers, and its voice is soft. Speaking in her half-Bedouin accent, she told Sana about the messenger of death. The messenger came in the morning and told me to get ready. And she told Sana how she wanted to be prepared for burial.
أمسكتني من يدي قالت سناء وأخذتني إلى بيتها فتحت غزامتها الخشبية البنية وأرتني الكفن الحريري الأبيض وقالت لي أنها ستتحمم قبل أن تنام أم الطاهرة ولا أريد أحدا على غسلي إلا أنت.
She took me by the hand, said Sana, led me to her house, opened her wooden trunk, and showed me the white silk shroud. She told me she would bathe before she went to sleep. I'll die pure, and I want only you to wash me.
ماتت أم حسن.
أم حسن is dead.
كل الناس كانوا يعرفون أن صباح هذا الاثنين 20 تشرين الثاني 1995 سوف يكون موعد نبيلة بنت فاطمة مع الموت.
Everyone knew that this Monday morning, November 20th, 1995, was the time set for Nabila, Fatima's daughter, to meet death.
استفاق الناس وانتظروا ولم يمتلك أحد جرأة الذهاب إلى بيتها من أجل اكتشاف موتها. فأم حسن أخبرت الجميع والجميع صدقها.
Everyone awoke and waited, but no one was brave enough to go to her house to discover she was dead. Umm Hassan had told everyone, and everyone believed her.
أنا وحدي فوجئت.
Only I was taken by surprise.
بقيت معك حتى الحادية عشر ليلة ثم دخلت غرفتي منهكا ونمت وكان ليل المخيم نائما فلم يخبرني أحد.
I stayed with you until 11 at night and then exhausted I went to my room and slept. It was night, the camp was asleep and no one told me.
أما الناس فكانوا يعلمون.
But everyone else knew.
لا أحد لا يصدق أم حسن فهي لا تقول إلا الحقيقة. ألم تكن وحدها من بكى صباح الخامس من حزيران عام 1967؟
No one would question Umm Hassan because she always told the truth. Hadn't she been the only one to weep on the morning of June 5th, 1967?
الناس رقصوا في الشوارع استعدادا للعودة إلى فلسطين. أما هي فبكت. قالت لمن رأته إنها قررت لبس الحداد.
Everyone was dancing in the streets, anticipating going home to Palestine, but she wept. She told everyone she decided to wear mourning.
ضحك الجميع عليها وقالوا إن أم حسن أصيبت بالجنون. وخلال أيام الحرب الستة الطويلة لم تفتح نوافذ بيتها. وفي اليوم السابع خرجت لتمسح دموع الناس. قالت إنها تعرف ففلسطين لن تعود.
Everyone laughed and said Umm Hassan had gone mad. Throughout the 6 long days of the war, she never opened the windows of her house. On the 7th, out she came to wipe away everyone's tears. She said she knew Palestine would not come back until all of us had died.
خلال سنواتها الطويلة دفنت أم حسن أولادها الأربعة واحدا بعد الآخر.
Over the course of her long life, Umm Hassan had buried her 4 children, one after the other.
كانوا يأتون محمولين على خشبة والدم يغطي ثيابهم.
They would come to her borne on planks, their clothes covered in blood.
ولم يبقى لها سوى ابن اسمه ناجي يعيش في أمريكا.
All she had left was a son called Naji, who lived in America.
وناجي ليس ابنها الحقيقي لكنه ابنها. التقطته من تحت شجرة زيتون على طريق الكابري ترشيحة وأرضعته من ثديها الناشفين ثم أعطته لأمه في قرية قانا اللبنانية.
Though Naji wasn't her real son, he was. She had picked him up from beneath an olive tree on the Kabri Tarshia road and had fed him from her dry breasts, then returned him to his mother when they reached the village of Qana in Lebanon.
اليوم ماتت أم حسن.
أم حسن died today.
لم يجرؤ أحد على دخول بيتها.
No one dared to go into her house.
تجمعت حوالي 20 امرأة أمام الباب ينتظرن.
About 20 women gathered to wait. Then Sana came and knocked on the door, but no one opened it.
ثم جاءت سناء قرعت الباب فلم يفتح أحد. دفشته فانفتح ودخلت مهرولة إلى غرفة النوم. كانت أم حسن نائمة ورأسها مغطى بمنديلها الأبيض.
She pushed it. It opened. She went in and ran to the bedroom. Hassan was sleeping, her head covered with her white headscarf.
اقتربت منها سناء أمسكتها من كتفيها فتسربت برودة جسد المرأة إلى كفي زوجة بائع الكنافة التي صرخت ودخلت النسوة وبدأ البكاء يعلو وتراقد الناس.
Sana went over and took her by the shoulders and the chill of death flowed into the hands of the kanafa seller's wife who screamed. The women entered. The weeping began. And everyone raced to the house.
وأنا أيضا أريد أن أرقد مع الراقدين وأدخل مع الداخلين كي أرى أم حسن تنام في سريرها إلى الأبد وتتنشق رائحة الزيتون التي يعبق بها بيتها الصغير.
I too would like to run with the others, go in with them, see Hassan sleeping her eternal sleep, and breathe in the smell of olives that clung to her small home.
ولكنني لم أبكي.
But I didn't weep.
منذ ثلاثة أشهر وأنا عاجز عن الانفعال. فقط هذا الرجل المعلق فوق سريره يجعلني أحس برعشة الأشياء.
For 3 months I've been incapable of reacting. Only this man floating above his bed makes me feel the throb of life.
منذ ثلاثة أشهر وهو ملقا فوق سريره في مستشفى الجليل حيث أعمل طبيبا أو حيث أدعي أنني طبيب.
For 3 months he's been laid out on his bed in Galilee Hospital where I work as a doctor or where I pretend that I'm a doctor.
أجلس إلى جانبه وأحاول أميت هو أم حي لا أدري أساعده أم أعذبه أحبه أم أكرهه أروي له أم أستمع إليه.
I sit next to him and I try. Is he dead or alive? I don't know. Am I helping or tormenting him? Should I tell him stories or listen to him?
منذ ثلاثة أشهر وأنا في غرفته.
For 3 months I've been in this room.
اليوم ماتت أم حسن. أريده أن يعرف الخبر لكنه لا يسمع. أريده أن يأتي معي إلى جنازتها لكنه لا ينهض.
Today Hassan died and I want him to know, but he doesn't hear. I want him to come with me to her funeral. But he won't get up.
قالوا إنه أصيب بالكوما.
They said he fell into a coma.
انفجار في الدماغ نتج عنه عطب دائم. رجل مرمي أمامي وأنا هنا لا أعرف ماذا يجب أن أفعل. فقط أحاول أن لا أتركه يتعفن حيا. فأنا متأكد أنه نائم وليس ميتا.
An explosion in the brain causing permanent damage. A man lies in front of me and I have no idea what to do. I'll just try not to let him rot while he's still alive because I'm sure he's asleep, not dead.
ولكن ما الفرق؟
But what difference does it make?
هل صحيح ما روته أم حسن أن النائم مثل الميت؟ فالروح تغادر جسد النائم ثم تعود إليه حين يستيقظ. أما الميت فروحه تغادره ولا تعود.
Is it true that Hassan said about a sleeper being like a dead man, that the sleeper's soul leaves his body only to return when he wakes, but that the dead man's soul leaves and doesn't come back?
أين روح يونس بن إبراهيم بن سليمان الأسدي?
Where is the soul of Yunus, son of Ibrahim, son of Suleiman al-Asadi?
هل غادرته إلى البعيد أم هل تحوم فوقنا في غرفة هذا المستشفى وتطلب مني أن لا أغادر المكان؟ لأن الرجل مستلق في ظلمات بعيدة ويخاف الصمت.
Has it left him for a distant place, or is it hovering above us in the hospital room, asking me not to go because the man is immersed in distant darknesses, afraid of the silence?
والله لا أعرف.
I swear I've no idea.
أم حسن قالت في زيارتها الأولى إن يونس يتعذب، وقالت إنه أصبح في برزخ غير برزخنا.
On her first visit, Hassan said that Yunus was in torment. She said he was in a different place from us.
وماذا أفعل؟ سألتها. افعل ما يقوله، جاوبتني.
So what should I do? I asked her. Do what he tells you, she answered.
لكنه لا يحكي، قلت. بلى يحكي، قالت. وعليك أن تسمع صوته.
But he doesn't speak, I said. Oh yes, he does, she said. And it's up to you to hear his voice.
وأنا لا أسمع، والله لا أسمع. لكني مسمر على هذا الكرسي أحكي وأحكي.
And I don't hear it. I swear I don't. But I'm stuck to this chair and I talk and talk.
قل لي أيها الرجل، ماذا يجب أن أفعل؟
Tell me, I beg of you, what should I do?
أجلس إلى جانبك وأستمع إلى بكاء الناس الذي يشق نافذة غرفتك، ألا تسمع؟
I sit by your side and listen to the sound of weeping coming through the window of your room. Can't you hear it?
كل الناس يبكون، فلماذا لا تبكي؟
Everyone else is weeping, so why don't you?
صرنا ننتظر مناسبة للبكاء، فالدموع محبوسة داخل عيوننا، وأم حسن فجرت مكامن الدمع، فلماذا لا تنهض وتبكي؟
It's become our habit to look out for occasions to weep, for tears are dammed up behind our eyes. Hassan has burst open our reservoir of tears. Why won't you get up and weep? You've been listening to Elias Khoury read his novel Gate of the Sun in the original Arabic. I've been reading the translation by Humphrey Davies, recently published by Archipelago Books in New York. Thank you so much for the reading, Elias.
Thank you.
It's an extraordinary opening to the book. There are a couple of questions I'd like to ask you about it. The novel opens on November 20th, 1995, or that's the day in which Hassan dies, November 20th, 1995. Also is the day that the interim agreement, Oslo II, signed between the PLO and Israel, one that an agreement that kind of wrote off all the Palestinians in refugee camps, wrote off the right of return. Can you comment on that juxtaposition between Hassan's death and that significant date?
Actually, this day is, or this moment in Palestinian history was supposed to be a turning point. Hopefully that the Oslo agreement would have led to something. And you see in the novel all the time, Yunus will say, back to the beginning, that is, every time we have to begin from zero. And at that moment, everybody believed, although that the refugees were left behind, but everybody believed, or at least had the illusion, that this re-beginning from zero has to stop, and there is something new. And so when there is something new, a whole generation was collapsing, a whole generation was leaving, the battlefield was dying, and a new generation was taking over. But unfortunately... Unfortunately, it seems that Yunus was right and I was wrong, that we have to begin once again from zero. I think the Palestinians now are once again in the zero point.
Figures of the refugee camps and the massacres at Sabra and Shatila play an important role in the book. Can you comment on the shadow they, more than the shadow, the light that they pour onto your novel and the contemporary circumstances? When you say we're back to zero, back to a starting point from which one would have to begin to reimagine some possible accommodation, I guess...
Shatila camp is a very special place, because Shatila camp went through two big massacres. The first one was in September 1982, when the Israeli troops occupied Beirut, and the Israeli troops aided their Lebanese allies to commit the massacre. And the second one took place in 1986-87 through what we call in Lebanon the War of the Camps, where the militia, a local militia allied to Syria, where the back of the Syrian army tried to invade the camp and actually destroyed half of it. So it's a very real and symbolic place at the same time. It's a place where Palestinian identity, where we know how high is the price of the Palestinian identity, and how high is the price of Palestinians to take their destiny in their own hands. And in this sense, it's the most tragic part of it is that the Palestinians who were massacred in 1982 were buried in a collective tomb, and then unfortunately this tomb became a dump, actually. And the Palestinians, with their friends, the Lebanese friends, had to wait a long struggle in order to build a wall around the tomb, so that at least these hundreds who were killed have a place to rest in the end. So in this sense, Shatila is very, very important and symbolic. And you know, the Palestinian refugees in Lebanon are all from Galilee originally. And when Israel invaded Lebanon in 1982 to destroy the PLO, and the outcome of it was the Shatila massacre, it was the operation, paradoxically, the Israeli operation was called Peace for Galilee. And actually, it was against the Galileans themselves. So you have here a whole bunch of mythical and of symbolic situation with a reality, which is the reality of being a refugee and being separated from your land and being obliged to live in a suspended life. So I think this is the importance of why Shatila massacre is here. Anyway, the whole novel takes place in Shatila camp, in the hospital in Shatila, and you cannot be in Shatila without having all this, the impact of the massacre of 1982.
Yeah, clearly that but choosing Shatila as the fulcrum for the book, that the massacres, the two massacres, are foregrounded in a way that is not ideological, but simply bound up with the narrative and the reality the narrative brings forth. There is a quote, an interesting quote from Khalil, the main character, that reads this way, and quoting now from Humphrey Davies's translation of your book, Gates of the Sun: "Everything here isn't itself, but a simulacrum of itself. We say house, but we don't live in houses. We live in places that resemble houses. We say Beirut, but we aren't really in Beirut. We're in a semblance of Beirut. I say doctor, but I'm not a doctor. I'm just pretending to be one. Even the camp itself, we say we're in the Shatila camp, but after the war of the camps and the destruction of 80% of Shatila's houses, it's no longer a camp. It's just a semblance of a camp." So this complicated dialectic between simulacra and reality, or a kind of hall of mirrors and multiplicity of possible stories, right, and a circumstance whose imperative can't be denied, very much your book is concerned with. Can you comment a little bit about the relationship between this simulacrum and the imperative fact?
Actually, the situation of the camps, the daily life, makes it that you have, if you live in a Palestinian refugee camp, you have to invent your life every day. That is, and so life is a combination of memory and imagination, and I think this is literature also. So I didn't discover anything. What I did in this book was that I went and lived with them, and I learned from them how literature must be written, and how actually you have a whole people who is living, let's say, in a literary situation, in a very dramatic situation. Normally we read a book, and every book is painful. Okay, after that we go for a drink. Here you are living inside the book, and you can go nowhere, and you have to stay inside that book and to reinvent it every day. And in this sense, I think the Palestinian strategy is now a challenge for our human feelings, our human affiliation, because no one can stay neutral before a tragic situation like that, and no one have the right to neglect or to forget, because this is a huge wound which has been opened since 60 years, and it's still open.
Yeah, Edward Said has said about you, Elias Khoury, that you are an artist giving voice to rooted exiles and trapped refugees, to dissolving boundaries and changing identities, to radical demands and new languages. And that from this perspective, Khoury's work bids Mahfouz an inevitable and yet profoundly respectful farewell. Well, that's an interesting polemical aside, but the fact is that, especially in an American circumstance, the voice of the exiles that you're giving voice to is rarely heard. And for that reason alone, Gate of the Sun is an important book. Then when one thinks about the complicated narrative strategies you pursue there, it becomes certainly not a political work, but an important literary happening or event. You've been traveling a lot with the book, doing a lot of readings. I know you'll be in Seattle sometime this spring. What kind of reception have you been receiving when you read from the book or speak about your work around the country?
Actually, I'm really astonished by the reception. I was not expecting this very, very warm reception. And not only by the readers, but also by the press and by the media, which really gives me hope. I think one from outside can see things either black or white, but things are not like that. And if we can really speak the voice of the voiceless, then I'm sure we'll be heard, and I'm sure many, many readers, either Americans or French or Germans or even Israelis, can identify with the characters of this novel. And I think this is the other part of our struggle nowadays. The major struggle is to replace this hysterical situation of identity by identification. I think identification is the only way for us to deserve really to be human beings.
Yeah, interesting what you say, that also perhaps the book appreciated or received by Israelis. I note that the first language your book was translated into was Hebrew, and that and therefore has a life in Israel. What kind of reception has Gate of the Sun received in its Hebrew form?
Naturally, the first translation was French, and the Hebrew was the second one. But nonetheless, it was from the first translations. And also, it was very interesting, the reaction to the Hebrew translation was really very interesting. A lot of book reviews in the newspapers, and the book sold really very well. And the reactions I can feel here in New York, because I cannot feel them elsewhere. But I meet many young students who are coming from Israel. The reaction is more than good. I mean, this idea of identification, at last we can arrive to a point when if an Israeli can identify with a Palestinian with tragedy, then I think this is the first step towards finding a real solution.
Speaking with Elias Khoury about his book, Gate of the Sun. Elias, it's been a pleasure talking together, and I really enjoyed reading from your book together. That was
Thank
a thrill.
You.
Thanks
Thank
so much
you.
For taking some
My
time.
My pleasure. Thank you very much.
We've been speaking with Elias Khoury, Lebanese author, novelist, author of Gate of the Sun. Stay tuned for more of Cross-Cultural Poetics after this.